A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been looking at the Iranian ballistic missile program, and what jumped out at him is how wildly varied it is. You've got solid fuel, liquid fuel, systems from the 1980s sitting alongside things developed in the last 5 years, all operated by the same branch of the IRGC. His question is basically, what are the actual disadvantages of running a missile program this fragmented? And how would their real-world battle preparation look different from a military, like the US, which operates a much smaller range of weapon types? There's a lot to dig into here.
The first thing worth nailing down is the sheer scale of the variety we're talking about. The IRGC Aerospace Force operates roughly 12 distinct ballistic missile systems. That's not variants, that's entirely different platforms. You've got the Shahab family, which are basically evolved, Scuds, liquid-fueled, originally North Korean designs. Then you've got the Goddard and EMAD, which are Iranian modifications on those. Then the solid-fuel Fateh family, the Zulfikar, the Dezful. Then the Kaibar Shekin, which is a newer solid-fuel system, and the liquid-fuel Khorramshahr. And the Kayem, which is a liquid fuel Scud derivative that got rid of the tail fins. And that's not even counting the cruise missiles and the anti-ship stuff that also falls under their umbrella.
The US Army operates, what, one?
The US ground-based ballistic missile deterrent is the Minuteman III, and that's an Air Force system. The Army's tactical ballistic missile is the ATACMS, which is being replaced by the precision strike missile, but it's a single lineage. The Navy has the Trident D-5, so across the entire U.S. military, you're looking at maybe 3 or 4 distinct ballistic missile platforms, and they're all developed through a unified acquisition system with common logistics. Iran has 12 under one branch of one service.
The first disadvantage is obvious. You've built a logistical nightmare.
A logistical nightmare that compounds at every level. Each liquid fuel system requires its own specific fuel and oxidizer. The Shahab 3 uses TM-185, which is a gasoline-kerosene blend, with AK-27I as the oxidizer, which is basically red-fuming nitric acid. The Khorramshahr almost certainly uses different propellant chemistry. Even if the fuel is chemically similar, the ground support equipment, the pumps, the seals, the storage tanks, may not be interchangeable. So you're not just maintaining 12 missiles. You're maintaining 12 separate supply chains, 12 sets of test equipment, 12 training pipelines.
Liquid fuel is already a pain to begin with. You can't just leave the stuff sitting in the missile.
Liquid fuel missiles generally can't be stored fueled. The oxidizer in particular is corrosive. It'll eat through seals and tank walls over time. So you fuel them shortly before launch, which means you need a whole fueling infrastructure at every launch site. Or you need to do it at a preparation area and then move the missile, which creates a vulnerability window. The fueling process for a Scud-type missile takes something like 30 to 60 minutes if the crew is well trained, during which the missile is completely exposed. You can't hide a missile being fueled. The vapor plume from the oxidizer is visible. The thermal signature is enormous. And if anything goes wrong, you've just created a toxic chemical spill at your own launch position.
Iran has what? Half a dozen different liquid fuel systems.
The Shahab 1 and 2, which are shorter range Scud variants. The Shahab 3 and its derivatives, the Goddard and EMAD. Each has its own fueling procedure, its own oxidizer handling requirements, its own countdown sequence. If you're a liquid fuel missile crew in the IRGC, you're probably trained on one system, maybe two, because the procedures are so system specific. So right away, you've got a personnel management problem where you can't just cross-train crews the way you could if everything was standardized.
If you lose the Shahab 3 crews, you can't just slot the Chiam crews into their positions.
And the US solved this problem decades ago by moving almost entirely to solid fuel. A Minuteman III, or a Trident, is basically a sealed unit. The propellant is cast into the motor when it's built, it's stable for decades, and the missile just sits in its silo or tube waiting for a launch command. No fueling, no oxidizer handling, no countdown procedures that involve hazardous chemicals. The launch prep is essentially verify the guidance system, open the silo door, send the fire command. Minutes at most.
Which brings us to the second disadvantage. Iran's variety means they can't have a unified command and control doctrine.
This is the part that doesn't get discussed enough. When every system has a different timeline from alert to launch, you can't plan a coordinated strike. If you want to launch a salvo that arrives on target simultaneously, which is how you overwhelm missile defenses, you need to sequence your launches backward from the time on target. The solid fuel missiles can launch in minutes. The liquid fuel ones need an hour or more of prep. So your faster systems have to sit and wait while the slower ones fuel up, which means you're keeping armed missiles exposed on the surface for an extended period while you synchronize. Or you accept that your salvos will arrive staggered, which makes them much easier for defenses to handle.
The musical equivalent of an orchestra where half the musicians are playing from a different score.
The conductor's stand is on fire. But there's a deeper issue too, and this gets to something I've thought about before. The IRGC doesn't retire systems, they accumulate them, and the reason is they can't afford to retire anything. Every missile body represents a sunk cost in a severely resource-constrained program, and they treat hardware as precious in a way the US simply doesn't.
Like a museum that's also expected to fight a war.
A museum where every exhibit has to be kept in working order. The Shahab 1 entered service in the late 1980s. It's a Scud B clone with a range of about 300 kilometers and an accuracy you'd describe as pointed in the general direction. By any modern standard, it's obsolete. But Iran still maintains them, still trains crews on them, still includes them in exercises. Because retiring them means admitting the investment is lost, and for a program built on scarcity and sanctions evasion, every missile is a strategic asset even if its military utility is marginal.
The U.S., by contrast, retires systems aggressively because the cost of maintaining old hardware exceeds the cost of replacing it.
Because standardization means a new system slots into an existing logistics and training infrastructure. When the U.S. moved from the Peacekeeper to having just the Minuteman III, they didn't lose capability. They gained reliability and reduced cost. The IRGC can't do that because each system was acquired under different circumstances, often through different procurement channels with different industrial partners. The Shahab came through North Korea. The Fateh family was domestically developed. The Qorumshahr seems to draw on technology from multiple sources, possibly including Russian expertise. You can't standardize across systems that were never designed to be compatible.
There's a third disadvantage that's less obvious, but maybe more important.
If you're the IRGC Aerospace Force and you need to maintain proficiency on 12 different systems, your training budget gets divided 12 ways. A U.S. missile crew trains on one system and drills constantly. They know every failure mode, every procedure, every workaround. An IRGC crew might train on a Shahab 3 and have some familiarity with a Goddard, but they're not going to have deep expertise across the entire arsenal. And that matters enormously when things go wrong, because things always go wrong.
The difference between a specialist and someone who's read the manual.
With ballistic missiles, the failure modes are catastrophic. A fueling error with red fuming nitric acid doesn't just mean the mission fails. It means you've killed your crew and contaminated your launch site. A guidance system misconfiguration doesn't just mean you miss the target. It means you might hit something you didn't intend to, which for Iran, given their targeting history, is a particularly sensitive issue.
Let's go there. The prompt specifically notes that Iran uses these missiles to target civilians in other countries, which the US doesn't do with its ballistic missile arsenal.
That's not editorializing. It's a documented fact. Iran has supplied missiles to the Houthis in Yemen that have been fired at civilian populations in Saudi Arabia and the UAE. They've transferred systems to Hezbollah. Their own strikes have hit civilian areas. The U.S. Ballistic Missile Force exists for strategic deterrence. It's designed to never be used, and if it were used, the targets would be military and industrial. The doctrine is completely different.
Which feeds back into the variety problem. If your doctrine involves hitting civilian populations, which is inherently a terror strategy rather than a military one, precision matters less, but volume and unpredictability matter more. Having 12 different systems might actually serve that purpose.
That's a really uncomfortable point, but I think you're right. If your goal is to create terror, to demonstrate reach, to make populations feel unsafe anywhere, than having a grab bag of different missiles with different flight profiles, different ranges, different trajectories, makes it harder for civil defense to prepare. If a population knows that the incoming threat is always a Shahab 3 with a known flight time, they can optimize their warning systems and shelter protocols around that. If it could be a Shahab 3, a Goddard, a Kaibar Shikan, a Desful each with different flight characteristics, the uncertainty itself becomes a weapon.
The defense has to prepare for everything, which means they're optimally prepared for nothing.
But the flip side, and this is where the variety really hurts them, is that when you actually want to achieve a specific military effect, all that variety becomes a liability. If you need to destroy a hardened target, you need a specific warhead, a specific accuracy, a specific terminal velocity. Not every missile in your arsenal can do that job. So you're forced to use whatever system fits the mission profile, and if that system is a liquid-fueled dinosaur that needs an hour of prep, your operational security is blown before you even launch.
Let's talk about what actual battle preparation looks like for the IRGC versus the US. Walk me through it.
Let's imagine a scenario. Tensions have escalated, and both the US and Iran are preparing for a possible strike. For the US, the preparation is mostly invisible. A Minuteman III crew in a launch control center in Wyoming or Montana receives an alert. They run through authentication procedures. The missiles are already fueled, already targeted, though targeting can be updated remotely. The physical preparation of the missile itself is essentially zero. The constraint is the human decision chain, not the hardware.
The missile has been ready since the Reagan administration.
Some of those Minuteman motors were cast in the 1970s, and they're still perfectly viable. The U.S. preparation cycle is measured in minutes from decision to launch, and most of that is human verification to prevent an unauthorized launch. For Iran, the picture is completely different. If they're preparing a liquid fuel strike, the first thing that happens is the missile is moved from its storage site to a preparation area. That movement itself is detectable. Transporter Erector Launchers, or TELs, are large vehicles that show up on satellite imagery. Once at the preparation area, the missile is erected vertically, and then the fueling process begins, which, again, takes 30 to 60 minutes and produces visible signatures.
The preparation is inherently observable.
Inherently and unavoidably. And this is where Iran has tried to adapt. They've invested heavily in underground missile cities, tunnel complexes where missiles can be stored, prepared, and even launched from within mountains. We've seen the propaganda footage. The idea is to hide the preparation cycle from overhead surveillance. But the problem is that even an underground facility needs surface access for the missile to exit, and those exit points are observable. You can hide the fueling, but you can't hide the launch.
If you're preparing a coordinated strike with mixed solid and liquid systems, the solid fuel missiles are ready to go, while the liquid ones are still being fueled, which means your whole strike package is paced by the slowest system.
The pacing problem is real, and it gets worse when you consider that Iran's command and control is probably not as resilient as they'd like it to be. The U.S. has spent decades hardening its nuclear command and control against every conceivable threat. Electromagnetic pulse, decapitation strikes, cyber attacks. The IRGC's command and control for conventional ballistic missiles is almost certainly less robust. If you're trying to coordinate 12 different systems with different timelines through a command structure that might be under attack, the probability of something going wrong compounds quickly.
What you're describing is a force that looks impressive in a parade, but would be extremely difficult to employ effectively in a real conflict.
That's the tension at the heart of Iran's missile program. On paper, they have a large and diverse arsenal, the largest in the Middle East by most estimates. They've demonstrated range, they've demonstrated willingness to use these systems, they've shown improvements in accuracy. But the operational reality of actually employing that arsenal in a coordinated way against a capable adversary is a completely different problem than firing a handful of missiles in a demonstration strike, which is what we've mostly seen.
The April 2024 attack on Israel is probably the best real-world example we have.
Iran launched something like 300 projectiles, a mix of ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, and drones, and we saw the pacing problem play out in real time. The drones were launched first because they're slow, the cruise missiles next, and the ballistic missiles last, all sequenced so that they'd arrive roughly simultaneously. And the result was that almost everything was intercepted. The attack telegraphed itself hours in advance, and the variety of systems didn't create enough confusion to overcome the defenders' preparation.
The U.S., by contrast, would never telegraph a strike that way, because the preparation cycle is so compressed.
A U.S. strike with conventional ballistic missiles, which would almost certainly be launched from naval platforms, not ground-based systems, would have a preparation cycle measured in minutes. The missiles are in vertical launch cells, they're solid fuel, they're already targeted or can be targeted rapidly. There's no fueling, no erecting, no visible preparation. A Ticonderoga-class cruiser, or an Arleigh Burke destroyer, just sails into position and fires. The first indication the target has that a strike is incoming is when the missiles appear on radar.
The operational advantage isn't just technological, it's procedural. The U.S. has compressed the preparation cycle to the point where it's essentially invisible.
That compression is only possible because of standardization. Every Tomahawk, every SM-6, every forthcoming hypersonic is designed to work within the same launch infrastructure, the same command and control architecture, the same targeting system. You don't need different crews for different missiles. The Combat Information Center on a destroyer can manage multiple weapon types through the same interface. That's the payoff of decades of disciplined acquisition.
Which brings me to a question. Iran has presumably developed deep professional expertise in what they do. The prompt acknowledges that. So why haven't they standardized? It's not like they don't understand the advantages.
I think the answer is that they couldn't, even if they wanted to. Standardization requires a domestic industrial base that can produce everything you need. Iran's missile program has been built under sanctions for decades. They've had to acquire technology through cutouts, reverse engineer foreign systems, and work with whatever components they can get. You can't standardize when your supply chain is opportunistic. If you get access to a new guidance system through a smuggling network, you build a missile around it. You don't wait until you can build a standardized fleet.
The variety is a symptom of the sanctions regime, not a deliberate design choice.
It's an adaptation to scarcity. Each missile system represents a moment when Iran got access to something, a technology, a design, a component, and built a capability around it. The Shahab-3 came from North Korean Nodong technology. The Fateh family grew out of the Zelzal artillery rockets and incorporated whatever guidance technology Iran could develop or acquire. The Khorramshahr seems to draw on multiple lineages. Each system is a snapshot of what was possible at a particular moment under a particular set of constraints.
Like a fossil record of sanctions evasion.
That's exactly what it is. And the fossil record tells you a lot about how the program evolved, but it also tells you that Iran has never been in a position to make a clean sheet decision about what its missile force should look like. They've never had the luxury of saying, we're going to standardize on two systems and retire everything else. Every retirement means losing a capability that took enormous effort to build and might be impossible to replace.
There's also a bureaucratic angle here. The IRGC is not a unified organization with a single procurement authority. Different factions have different priorities, different relationships with suppliers, different patronage networks. 12 missile systems might reflect 12 different internal constituencies that each need to be fed.
That's speculative, but probably true. Military procurement everywhere is political. The U.S. is hardly immune to that, but in a system like the IRGC, where the line between military, industrial, and political interests is deliberately blurred, you'd expect even more of it. A missile system isn't just a weapon, it's a budget, a command billet, a prestige project, a network of suppliers and subcontractors who have political connections. Canceling a system means canceling all of that.
You end up with what looks like a coherent arsenal, but is actually a coalition of independent fiefdoms.
Each with its own logistics, its own training, its own operational procedures. And the commander, who has to actually employ this force in combat, is essentially herding cats, each of which requires a different kind of food and a different kind of litter box.
There's an image.
It captures the problem. The U.S. solved this by centralizing acquisition under a unified system with clear doctrine. The IRGC operates more like a confederation of missile programs that happen to share a chain of command. In peacetime, that works well enough for parades and exercises and the occasional demonstration strike. In a real conflict against a capable adversary, the coordination problems would be severe.
Let's talk about one more disadvantage that we haven't touched on. Maintenance and reliability.
This is where the variety really punishes you. Ballistic missiles are complex machines with a finite shelf life, especially liquid fuel systems. Guidance systems drift. Propellant chemistry changes over time. Solid rocket motors can develop cracks in the propellant grain. If you have 12 different systems, you need 12 different inspection and maintenance programs, 12 sets of spare parts, 12 sets of specialized tools, and test equipment.
12 different failure modes to diagnose.
The diagnostic expertise doesn't transfer. A technician who knows how to troubleshoot a Shahab 3's guidance system may have no idea how to diagnose a problem in a Kaibar Shikan because the underlying technology is completely different. The Shahab 3 uses a mechanical gyroscope-based inertial navigation system that's essentially 1960s technology. The Kaibar Shikan almost certainly uses a solid-state system with ring laser gyros or fiber optic gyros and satellite guidance augmentation. The failure modes are completely different, the test procedures are completely different, the spare parts are completely different.
If your maintenance fails, the missile either doesn't launch, launches and goes off course, or launches and blows up on the pad.
A launch failure doesn't just mean you lose the missile. It means you've revealed your launch position, possibly killed your crew, and demonstrated to your adversary that your arsenal isn't as reliable as you claim. For a deterrence posture that relies heavily on perceived capability, that's a significant political cost.
The U.S. had its share of launch failures over the decades, but they're rare precisely because the maintenance is standardized and the systems are well understood.
The U.S. tests constantly. The Minuteman III fleet undergoes regular test launches from Vandenberg, unarmed, just to verify that the systems still work. Those tests generate data that feeds back into the maintenance program. Iran tests much less frequently and doesn't have the same culture of data-driven maintenance. They're more likely to discover a problem when they try to use the missile in combat.
Which is the worst possible time to discover a problem?
It's the only time that matters. And this connects back to something important about the difference between a program built for deterrence and one built for actual use. The U.S. Ballistic Missile Force is designed to never be used. Its entire purpose is to make the other side believe it would work, so they never put you in a position where you have to find out. Iran's missile force, by contrast, has been used repeatedly, against ISIS in Syria, against Kurdish groups in Iraq, against Israel in April 2024. Each use is a test of the system under combat conditions, and each use either validates the capability or reveals its limitations.
Iran is effectively doing operational testing in combat, which is a very different model.
It's a model that works until it doesn't. The April attack revealed that Iran's ballistic missiles, in the numbers and configuration they used, could be largely defeated by a layered defense. That's valuable information for Iran. They now know what didn't work, but it's also valuable for everyone else, because it demonstrated that the threat, while real, is manageable.
Which might explain why they maintain such a varied arsenal. If one system proves ineffective, they've got 11 others to try.
Redundancy through diversity rather than redundancy through numbers. The U.S. approach is to have a smaller number of highly reliable systems and produce enough of them to saturate any conceivable defense. Iran's approach is to have a large number of different systems, any one of which might have a capability the adversary hasn't prepared for.
The Swiss Army knife approach to ballistic missiles.
Except each tool requires a different manual and a different set of skills. The question is whether that diversity actually translates into military effectiveness, or whether it's mostly useful for domestic propaganda and strategic signaling. And I think the answer is that it depends on the scenario. Against a non-state adversary or a regional power with limited defenses, the variety might actually be useful. It gives you options. Against a peer or near-peer adversary with a sophisticated, integrated air defense system, the coordination problems probably outweigh the benefits.
To wrap this back to the prompt's question, the disadvantages are logistical fragmentation, training dilution, command and control complexity, maintenance burden, operational predictability for liquid fuel systems, and the pacing problem in coordinated strikes. The battle preparation difference is that the U.S. prepares in minutes with an invisible footprint, while Iran's preparation for most of its systems takes hours and is inherently observable.
The deeper point is that Iran's variety isn't a strategy. It's an adaptation to a constrained environment. They didn't choose to operate 12 systems because it's optimal. They operate 12 systems because each one represents a hard-won capability that they can't afford to lose and can't easily replace with something standardized. It's the missile program equivalent of keeping every car you've ever owned running in the driveway, because you might need it someday.
Someday you look up and you've got 12 cars, none of them are particularly reliable, and you can only drive one at a time.
While your neighbor has two cars that both work perfectly and can be started from inside the house.
The neighbor being the United States in this metaphor.
The neighbor being the United States, with a heated garage and a maintenance schedule.
Of course there are.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the late Victorian period, permafrost in the Aleutian Islands was estimated to contain methane equivalent to roughly 400 million tons of coal, more than the entire annual output of the British Empire's collieries at the time.
Oh, right, right. The open question, I think, is whether Iran is actually trying to move towards standardization, or whether the sanctions environment makes that impossible for the foreseeable future. The Kaibarshikan and the newer solid fuel systems suggest they understand the advantages of solid fuel and faster launch cycles. But they're not retiring the old liquid fuel systems, they're just adding to the pile.
That's the pattern we should expect to continue. Iran will keep developing new systems as technology allows, but they won't retire the old ones because the cost of replacement is too high, and the political cost of admitting a system is obsolete is too great. The arsenal will get more diverse, not less, and the operational headaches will compound accordingly. Whether that eventually forces a reorganization or a culling of the arsenal is an open question, but I wouldn't bet on it happening soon.
Thank you to Hilbert Flemingtop for producing, and for that deeply unsettling methane fact.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you enjoyed this, leave us a review. It genuinely helps other people find the show.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.